It's now time for the MLB.com Cut Forecast. Cut Forecast. The Cut Forecast. It's a cast from Cut 4. Here it is.
Hello and welcome to the Cut Forecast. I'm Dakota Gardner. I am joined, as always, by Gemma Kaneko.
What's up?
And with us is the grand leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Cut 4, Ian Kay. Welcome.
I thought it was Supreme Leader.
Supreme Leader. I knew I messed it up. I'm so sorry.
You'll pay for that later.
Yeah, I will. We have a lot to talk about. The season is about to get underway. I'm happy to have both of you here. I feel like it's been a while since it's been the three of us.
Yeah.
It's been a few weeks.
Yeah.
It's been a few weeks. It's been a little bit.
And you never see us otherwise.
It's true. I never see you. But we got a lot to get to. We'll discuss Cut 4 favorite Munenori Kawasaki. We will also talk about a couple awesome posts that happened on MLB.com/cut4 this week, including some of the most watchable players and some of the best promotional items that you can pick up this season in your stadium, wherever is closest to you. But before we get to all of that, I am very excited to discuss this story because it involves things that I love. Business, ranking things, the Pope, LeBron James. It involves all of these things. Fortune magazine released its list of the world's greatest leaders. And you know who's at number one? No, it's not Angela Merkel, German chancellor. She is at number 10. No, it's not Jeff Bezos, leader of Amazon. He is at number 5. The number one greatest leader in the world is Theo Epstein of the Chicago Cubs. Gemma, do you agree with this ranking?
I have a lot of questions about the methodology here. I'm not really sure how one is determined to be the greatest leader in the world. Like, why would being a baseball leader be greater than leading a country or not? I just have so many questions. Good for Theo.
Good for Theo.
Though he himself seemed pretty surprised by this honor, saying that he wasn't even the best leader on the team. So
that is true. Joe Madden also was asked about this, and he said that the Pope didn't have as good of a year after all. Has he broken any 108-year-old curses lately? I agree with Joe. The Pope, if you're curious, came in third. Angela Merkel, 10, as I said. LeBron James, actually, in 11th.
Like, what kind of math determines that Angela Merkel is just slightly better at leading than LeBron? That's what I want to know.
That would be the math of Fortune magazine. Ian, what do you think? Are you excited? Are you happy?
Yeah, I'm excited. I mean, personally, I think the young Pope is the best leader of the year.
Shout out to Lenny Bilardo, future general manager.
Pius the 13th. But I think, you know, Theo's certainly up there as consideration for the best leader in baseball. And baseball is definitely a proxy for everything else that happens in the world. So
I agree.
I get behind it.
Yeah. I don't know. I find this very dubious. I find this all very dubious.
You don't like this at all.
It seems like there's a very mixed selection of people in here who it's like, if they all had brunch together, it would be awful. It would be terrible brunch.
It was a weird list.
Yeah.
All of the people that we've named were above, like, Justin Trudeau of Canada.
He's in the 30s somewhere, which is personally offensive to me. So.
H.R. McMaster was, like, 8 or 7, something like that.
Did he even make the top 10? Mysterious.
It's odd, but you know what? I agree that Theo Epstein is the world's greatest leader. Think
I mean, why isn't Jason Hayward the world's greatest leader? Because didn't he inspire everyone during the rain delay in Game 7 to somehow come back and win everything? Like, that is a story that is floating around, so should he not be the world's greatest leader?
I'm going to blow your mind. Who brought Jason Hayward to Chicago? Theo Epstein. Who brought a World Series to Chicago and the Boston Red, okay, the Chicago Cubs. Sorry, White Sox. To the Chicago Cubs and to the Boston Red Sox, Theo Epstein. The dude breaks curses, therefore he is the greatest leader in the world.
By that logic, wouldn't the people who brought Theo Epstein to the Cubs be the greatest leaders in the world?
Wow, what a good point.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. I didn't think about that.
Whose mind got blown now?
Ian is the greatest leader of cut for.
That is very, very true.
Supreme leader, Gemma.
You don't get to be the supreme leader of cut for without knowing how to define a good leader. But let's move on, because I don't know if there's much more to say about Theo Epstein being the world's greatest leader, because it's been printed, and so it's fact. What is an ongoing story, this is developing news, I would say. On Tuesday, we learned that the Cubs released 35-year-old utility infielder Munenori Kawasaki. He's only played in 14 games for the Cubs in 2016, and he's now gone. He was cut. He was released. Sadly, it's unclear what will happen to Kawasaki. MLB.com's Kerry Muskett talked to Joe Maddon, who said, quote, "The word release is a very harsh word, but I don't think it can be, but I think it can be rectified. I hope he comes back to us." I hope he comes back to them as well. It sounded like they really released him because they wanted him to have an opportunity to play for a major league team. And he wasn't going to have that in Chicago because that team is super loaded. Are we feeling happy that he has the opportunity to play elsewhere? Are we feeling sad that he is not with the Cubs anymore? Are we feeling a mixture of both? Ian?
Well, I'm certainly sad to see him get released, but I have a feeling we have not seen the last of Muni Kawasaki in the majors.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, a guy with his skills who can play a bunch of positions can, you know, probably has a pretty long career ahead of him still.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he'll hook on somewhere. So I think given what the Cubs roster looks like, you know, it could be for the best that we'll see him more in the majors with another team. So tentatively, I'm not that upset about it. If he ends up going back to Japan or retiring, then I would be much more sad.
Yeah. If he ends up retiring from baseball, totally, I'll be very sad. Even if he goes back to play in Japan, I mean, he'll still be playing baseball and it'll still be fun and we'll probably still get to see a lot of highlights. And if he plays in Japan, odds are he will get a lot more at-bats and, like, time to actually play. Mm-hmm. But I know that Joe Maddon doesn't want him to be gone. So we'll see. We'll see what happens, I guess.
That is a positive, not wanting him to be gone.
Yeah, he should come work for Cut 4.
Oh.
Because he is your personal friend.
Yeah.
Ian. Haven't you hung out with him like multiple times?
Depending on your definition of hung out, yes. I think I've told this story on the pod before, but back during the 2013 season, I believe, Muni gave his famous "I am Japanese" speech on the field post game after a Cubs win. And then he was later awarded the Cut 4 Topic of the Year Greatness in Baseball Award by MLB.com following that 2013 season. So obviously there's a massive trophy for that award, which, because it was Cut 4 Topic of the Year, I delivered to Muni at Yankee Stadium when he came through early in the 2014 season. So we talked then. We had a nice little chat. If you want to go search that video on MLB.com, it is there. It's us. I presented him with a large trophy. There were some translation issues, I would say, during our conversation. So I did meet him then. And then I met him a second time after that 2014 season in November at the Japan All-Star Series, where it was a team of kind of barnstorming U.S. players playing the Japanese national team at the Tokyo Dome at that point. It was sort of late in the series. And I'm standing in the press box in the Tokyo Dome, which is sort of up towards the top, and there's like rows of seats. And I see a guy, and I'm like, that's Muni. And he's just standing there in the press box. Like, I think he may have been working for a Japanese, you know, media organization of some kind. So, like, he technically was media, but
he's a mogul.
He is. But he had like cool glasses on. I think he had like a, you know, kind of dressy reporter guy outfit. And I was like, well, you know, I should go talk to him. So I loaded up the video of our previous interaction on my phone, because I sort of suspected correctly that he wouldn't recognize me. So I went over and I was like, hi, you know, Muni, can I talk to you for a sec? And once I showed him the video, then he remembered. And it was at that point that I got the only breaking news scoop of my life, which was that he was considering coming back to MLB, but was still undecided.
Ooh.
So I breathlessly reported that from my second meeting with Mooney. So I do hope that he returns to the majors, and I hope that we can meet again someday.
And then you can finally go do karaoke together, which is what I feel like you discussed when you met in Japan.
That's true.
Yes.
maybe it happened. I can't confirm.
Should he go to the Mets so that we can become best friends with him? Should he go to another team? Do you guys have an opinion where you want to see him?
How about the Yankees are in the market for a starting shortstop for the moment?
There you go. There you go. You heard it here first. The Yankees are absolutely 100% going to sign Munenori Kawasaki.
Real
to play
breaking
in their
news.
Infield.
Real breaking news.
That is breaking news, because Ian is in charge of the Yankees.
I know a lot of good karaoke spots in New York.
Jem
is laughing like we've never done karaoke before at one of them.
I'm laughing because I know that you have actual video of me doing karaoke where I foolishly have my video as Snapchat only, so it's gone.
I don't do karaoke.
It's in the cloud.
I just want everyone to know that I'm not a karaoke person. So.
Well, sad for you. It was really fun.
Such a bad opinion.
Yeah,
no, it's great. Well, what's your song, Ian?
It's tough. There's not really a lot that's within my range, I'd say, but The Gambler by Kenny Rogers is definitely one that I can handle.
Oh, my God.
God, that
there's
is...
some sentimental value there.
I'm sure.
All I need is somebody who knows the part, the Islands in the Stream part, because I do the Dolly Parton version, but it's very bad, but it's a duet, and no one knows the man's part to that song. So.
I wonder why.
Yeah, because it's a great song, okay?
Though
I prefer to do David Bowie because my voice is very deep when I sing, and it's also I have no range.
Also, David Bowie's great.
Yeah,
if you're gonna do any sort of karaoke, my vote is David Bowie.
Shout out to our Cut 4 favorite Matt Monaghan, who really likes to sing smooth and Piano Man.
That is true. Which MLB.com beat reporter is the best at karaoke?
Adam Berry.
You don't have to go into specifics, but I just want to know.
Adam Berry.
Yeah, Adam Berry. I would give a special shout out to Tony DiComo, who I've done karaoke with not only more than any other MLB.com beat reporter, but than any other person in my life.
That is true. That is true. Mets beat reporter Anthony DiComo. Incredible karaoke performer. Before we move on, we want to take a second to tell you about the Fantasy 411 podcast. Want to win your fantasy league this year? We are in a fantasy league. It for Cut 4, and I desperately want to win.
Do
and
you?
So I am subscribing to the Fantasy 411 podcast. Fred Zinke and Matthew Leach will cover the bases all spring and all season, giving you an edge over your friends and over these two losers in my fantasy league. No matter what kind of format you play, the MLB fantasy crew has been there and won that, and they will help you win too. The 411 has been releasing position-by-position breakdowns for the last few weeks, and Scott Pianowski of Yahoo Sports stopped by last week to talk about some late-round sleeper shortstops. So be sure to give those a listen before you draft and after you draft, and follow the Fantasy 411 podcast on iTunes today and all season long. Gemma, Ian, do you read Cut 4 on a regular basis? Is that something you enjoy doing?
I thought you were going to say something else rude about how we were going to lose in our fantasy league.
You are going to lose in the fantasy league. That's unrelated.
That's certainly untrue, but...
Do you guys read the website that
never.
You write for?
Never. I don't even know what that is.
No.
I don't
well,
know what
if
for
you
is.
Did, you would know that there's an article on there by our very own Michael Clare, friend of the pod, slash person who is on the podcast all the time. He ranked... Well, not ranked, I guess. He created a lineup of the 9 most watchable players in MLB. The guys you have to just tune in to your MLB.tv to watch. He gave us one for each position. Bartolo Colon may have made an appearance. I'm neither confirming nor denying that. My question to the two of you is, who do you think is the most watchable player in MLB? We're at the start of the season. Everybody's doing the thing where they're trying to decide which teams to follow throughout the year, follow closely. And I'm curious if you have any recommendations of guys to tune in for. Gemma, what do you think?
Well, I think the World Baseball Classic really did give us kind of a window into who's fun, like who's actually just a great time to watch. Not that we weren't already all watching Carlos Correa all the time anyway, but like Correa, Lindor, basically anyone who played for Team Puerto Rico, and they're super easy to find on the field now because their hair is bleach blonde.
That is
so
true.
I feel like anyone who looked like they were having a great time there is someone that I want to keep watching throughout the season.
Also, we should note that watchable, must watch. This doesn't mean these guys are the best players necessarily, and it doesn't mean if they're not on this list that the player is bad. It's just that, like, fun is a different thing that is quantified differently.
Yeah, well, like, quality. We talked about last week or maybe week before, the players who should just have cameras on them at all times, and Javi Baez was one, and I definitely just, we should do this. We need this to be a thing where certain Bryce probably deserves his own camera.
He definitely does. Yeah. Well, and, like, you know, Yasiel Puig, the year he broke out, was definitely the most fun player in MLB. Maybe not necessarily the best player, although one day he'll return to being the best player. But I'm sorry, I forget who you said.
Oh, I just mostly a bunch of guys who played for Puerto Rico.
That's right. Yes. Team Puerto Rico. Yes.
All of Team Puerto Rico.
Team Puerto Rico. Yes. Ian, who do you think is the most, like, must-watch player?
Yeah, I find myself gravitating towards the players who just look the most athletic and who, you know, they just move like they could be playing any sport. And luckily, we're sort of in a golden age of that right now. I mean, you mentioned Correa, but guys like Manny Machado, like Nolan Arenado, some of those like third baseman shortstops who, you know, they move in a way that like normal people don't move like that. You know, and like they can just pick the ball, plant, throw. I really like watching that. It's sort of one of those things that, like, even those basic plays that when a new season starts and, like, you know, you haven't seen it in a while. You know, spring training guys are not always going all out, or you just watch less. And then it's like, oh, even something as simple as fielding a grounder and firing to first, when those guys are doing it, looks special.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think there's something to be said for basically defense-first players, or players that, like, because, you know, you hit, and there's only so many things that can happen in an at-bat, and so, like, you know, home run is really exciting, but you're not going to see that many home runs throughout the year, probably, so it's not, to me, it's less, there's less moment-to-moment, oh, I have to watch this guy on offense than there is on defense, which is why I thought Kevin Pillar is really good player to watch. Corey Seager is another one who I think is just, like, really fun to watch play. But then if we're talking about guys who, like, just kind of dominate the game, like the actual thing that you are watching, I think it's hard to go with anything but, like, the most exciting starting pitcher, which for me is Clayton Kershaw, who I think personally is, I'm not gonna say he's underrated because he's not underrated, but I just think we don't talk about him enough. This happens in the NBA a lot, where, like, the best player doesn't always get the MVP because people get kind of sick of talking about him or whatever. And, like, you know, you could vote for LeBron James every year, but you don't. And I think that happens with Kershaw, where he's always great, and so people are always more interested in talking about the guy who's maybe having a comeback, or who's the exciting rookie or young player who's breaking out. And there's not as much love for, like, the guy who is the best pitcher on earth for 5 years running. And I just think, like, he's super fun to watch. Dodgers games generally are really telegenic. The stadium is great. Obviously, Vin Scully is retired now, and so you don't have that experience. But, like, the way he pitches is really exciting. The things that his pitches do, the way they move, is exciting to me. And I think he's the most watchable player in baseball. And to me, it's not even that close.
Yeah, well, I think that maybe we as Cut 4 don't talk about him all the time because he's definitely very watchable, but he's not in the dugout, like, making jokes and making goggles out of cups and pranking his teammates and goofing off, which is maybe what sometimes we want to see when we say, oh, there should be a camera on this player, you know? We want it because, yes, they're going to be making these incredible plays on the field, but they're also going to be, like, telling jokes and building castles out of garbage or whatever goes on. And, you know, There's that definition of watchable.
He also pretty much does have a camera on him the whole time anyway.
Yes, he makes some really good faces.
He does.
Yeah, he does make a lot of really good faces.
He's serious, but not in the same way that, like, a Madison Bumgarner is serious, which I
doesn't make
they
good
get
faces.
Compared all the time, and, you know, I'm probably playing into that now. But, like, he seems, even though he takes his job seriously, like, he takes himself less seriously. Maybe I'm projecting that onto him because I want that to be true. I have no idea. But to me, he's, like, the guy who I think it just you have to watch.
Yeah, I do think it's a good point because any hitter or any, you know, position player, they're going to get four or five at bats and they're going to field, you know, a handful of balls during the course of a game. But a pitcher, if you're talking about must watch, like, it is a little bit easier to have appointment viewing for a pitcher. And, you know, if you're talking about Kershaw, how at any given time in baseball, especially in the last, I don't know, 10 to 15 years, there have been a few guys who for a few years were clearly like the best pitcher. You know, if you go back, like Johan Santana for a few years was the best pitcher. Tim Lincecum had a run where he was probably the best pitcher. And now Kershaw's that guy. But I think it's, he's underrated in the sense that people don't realize that he is like better than the usual, the best pitcher by a significant margin. I think that that was actually a Matt Myers take that he is underrated for that reason. And like, it is something that, that we kind of take for granted and that we should, you know, all watch.
Yeah.
Because you never know. It's pitchers. They don't last forever.
I know. Any minute. And, you know, the guy he's compared to most often is also somebody who had, you know, arm issues. And so I just, to me, it's like I am focused on, I'm talking about Sandy Koufax. I just, to me, it's just, I didn't want to be weirdly cryptic. To me, it's just that I think it's not even that he's underrated, it's that he's underappreciated. And I think that that's the cut for take. It's not like value. It's about just like, as a society, I want us to value Clayton Kershaw more. That's what I want. There to be statues.
Look,
I want him to be in cool commercials.
Dakota,
what?
Are you the supreme leader of Cut 4? I don't know if you're allowed to dictate things to society if you are not the supreme leader.
That's true. That's a really good point. Ian, I'm trying to win you over here into my team Kershaw. It sounds like you're swayed.
I am swayed. I do think he's underappreciated. I think that's a good way to put it. He's not really underrated. But he is underappreciated, I think, just like in the national consciousness.
Yeah.
He should be more appreciated.
Yeah. Wow. Nation.
The supreme leader has ordered a statue
it,
be built.
Yes.
So.
Thus it has
of myself.
Been
in addition to Clayton Kershaw.
Just like hanging out.
Yeah.
Like
a statue of me and then a shorter statue of Clayton Kershaw would be ideal.
And then a separate statue of Munenori Kawasaki nearby.
Yes.
Okay. Let's move on from that to another piece that appeared on MLB.com/cut4 this week. It's also a piece by Michael Clare. He's writing the whole website for us. This piece is...
It can feel that way.
It sometimes does feel that way. This piece I was very excited by. It's a look at the year's best promotional items, bobbleheads, t-shirt giveaways, things along those lines. I love when that stuff happens. The Mets do the t-shirt Fridays where they give t-shirts to all the fans. I love all that stuff. So... was there anything, any of these promotions from this year that stuck out in your mind that is like, I want this? I think it was last year that they did, the Red Sox did that Build a Poppy.
Yeah.
We were very excited about that. Is there anything similar this year, Gemma?
I mean, I feel like we should just buy or go to the game and somehow like keep going through and pretend in disguises to this White Sox game that's going to have Hawk alarm clocks.
Yeah.
You could give those to everyone. You need one for yourself, obviously, but then you just need to give them to everyone in your life because whether you like someone or don't, it is the perfect item to give them.
Is it for someone that you like?
I want this really badly.
Well,
this was my pick.
So some people like Hawk.
I like
Hawk. Some
people
are like, you know what a great way to wake up? You know what a completely effective alarm you could never sleep through would be? Hawk Harrelson. It's actually great. You know, it's useful.
I don't think it actually talks to you. I know that there's been a misconception that the Hawk Harrelson alarm clock will shout Hawk catchphrases at you to wake you up. I don't believe that's what it is. My understanding is that it is a alarm clock with his face on it, and it says Hawk. And I want that because Hawk is great, and I want to continue to fight the good fight that Hawk Harrelson is actually great.
It doesn't have a Hawk catchphrase? That's not
I
that
don't
wakes
think
you up.
So. I'm pretty sure it just rings.
Oh, well, in that case, I'm slightly less excited. It's still cool, but my excitement is tempered a bit.
Any novelty alarm clock is a far better idea than reality. Like, can't you... Don't you have burned into your mind every alarm clock that you ever had?
Yeah. And that's why I want Hawk Harrelson's face burned into my mind.
But then doesn't it kind of ruin the thing itself
yes.
for you? Like, I used to wake up to a Kendrick Lamar song, and now I can't listen to that song.
Well, that's why it's better that it's ringing than a catchphrase. Because if it was a catchphrase, I would no longer be charmed when I hear, you can put it on a ball, yeah! Like, I am... I would just hear the, I would hear that and it would make me sad and angry. And now I would just hear the ring and I'd be like, what's waking me up? And I'll turn and I'll look and my head will still be on the pillow and I'll see the beautiful face of Hawk Harrelson. And I'll be like, oh, it's time to wake up. And it'll be like a Disney movie. Birds will dress me. It will be great.
Well.
I am convinced Hawk is good. Hawk is like the lunch meat that you get in like from Oscar Mayer or whatever, and it's very processed. And you might be like, oh no, this isn't good. But then you eat it enough that it's like it's familiar, and it makes you feel like a kid again, and it reminds you of like biting into that sandwich in like a high school or a middle school lunchroom. That is Hawk Harrelson to me.
That was an awful metaphor.
Hawk is like a lunch meat.
It's processed. Like,
he's like when
you don't like it, but then you eventually get used to eating it.
No, it's like if you were to sit down and try to explain to somebody why it's good, you would sound crazy. It's like, well, yes. it's all these parts of the cow or whatever thrown together into a meat. They'd be like, no, I'm not eating that. But then when they eat it, it's like, oh no, it's actually pretty good.
So Hawk is all the different parts of a cow.
No, you have to just give in to the like cheesiness, and that he's such a homer, and that he'll occasionally just go silent when bad things happen.
It's lunch meat, but there's cheesiness.
Yeah,
there's a whole sandwich going on here.
Ian, what promo item are you most excited
for? Well, while you guys are ripping yourselves out of the blissful comfort of sleep, I'm actually fading back into it with my Buster Posey Hugs blanket.
Mm-hmm.
I think we are on the same page in that like the functional giveaways are the way to go.
Yeah,
yes. You know, I like a bobblehead as much as the next person, but I love getting something I can actually use. I have like, you know, Yankee Stadium coffee mugs, at one point like water bottles, that kind of stuff. Love it. The Posey Hugs blanket, I think, is like one of the most creative giveaways that I've seen, because it's almost like, it's not like a super, super mainstream meme, Posey Hugged. It's like very much a nod to baseball Twitter kind of thing. But the way that it like has Posey on the blanket and then you can wrap it around yourself and get your own Posey hug, I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah.
It looks warm.
It does.
And who doesn't want to have a Posey hug?
What's the super trendy Swedish term?
Oh, yeah.
Hygge.
Something like that. I always.
What?
Yeah.
You haven't heard this?
No, I haven't heard this.
It's more like Hygge, right?
Yeah.
And it's some kind of Scandinavian thing.
It's like the act of being in a comfortable place.
Yeah.
It's like taking your shoes off and wrapping yourself in.
This whole thing, it happened.
Is there a Times
winter
article about it?
Yes. Yeah. And a New York, and every magazine and whatever. And there's a book that's out. It's like
course.
The art of.
I can see it made quite the impression on you guys.
However, since I all, it's like just be comfy.
Yes.
Like, I know how to do that. I don't need a book to tell me how to wrap myself in blankets and not go outside. Like.
That's true. I also do want to give a special shout out because Michael Clare wrote this post. I need to share what I think is his favorite, which is the Francisco Cervelli That's Amore bobblehead, in which he sings songs to you. It's a bobblehead. He's wearing like a smoking jacket or like a robe, and he's draped in roses. There's one in his pocket, and they're around his feet. It's very romantic. I think that's just a lovely giveaway. It's early in the season. It's April 8th, the Pirates versus Braves. So, check that out. Maybe send one to Michael Clare. I think he desperately wants one. So I just wanted to give a little shout out to that bobblehead.
It appreciates it.
I'm sure it does.
It'll sing you a song.
Hey, Gemma.
Hey, Dakota.
I didn't see you there. I heard that you interviewed Isla Borders.
I did. Yes, I did. I interviewed her, in fact, for this very podcast.
Tell me just briefly, who is Isla Borders?
So Isla Borders was the first woman to receive a college baseball scholarship. She's also the first woman to win an NAIA or NCAA baseball game, men's baseball game.
Mm-hmm.
She's great. She just wrote a book, and she came on to talk to us about it.
Well, let's listen.
Today, we're joined by Isla Borders, who many of you may know as the first woman to start a men's pro baseball game in the Independent Northern League. She's also the first woman to start a men's NAIA or NCAA college game and the first woman to get a win in one of those games and to get a baseball scholarship. She's had an incredible baseball career, and her memoir just came out called Making My Pitch. It's an incredible read. I suggest you all pick it up. And we are so lucky to have Isla here with us today. Hi, Isla.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for giving us a call. Thanks for chatting. Your book is astonishing. It's really good. It's such a good baseball book, just in terms of the behind the scenes, the dugout stories, bullpen tales. But there's also a lot of emotional labor in it, because you did not have the easiest time in the baseball world, which I think that many women can understand. What was it like reliving those things while writing this book?
People ask me all the time, they're like, why didn't you write it right when you retired? Why did it take 20 years? And I'm like, oh, my goodness, there's a lot of stuff that happened to me. And it's really difficult going through all those emotions and going through those journals. And you relive the good times and you relive the bad times. And it's a very difficult process. I'm proud of that process. I'm proud that it took me a little bit longer to complete, because I wrote it and I had a co-author that helped me. But you could tell it's an easy read, but it's very open, honest, and raw.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely the thing that stood out to me so much, is that you're so candid in it about all of these things that you went through. For example, you talk about in this one passage that really affected me, is that you talk about a player's girlfriend coming at you with a knife after her boyfriend fared poorly against you on the diamond, and other such incidences of violence like that. How does a person process that as a player and even after?
I think the toughest thing for me was keeping it all in. Mm-hmm. I really had to put out there that everything was okay. You know, I didn't want to disrupt the game. I didn't want to put any negative thoughts in anybody's mind that by a female playing baseball, or, you know, me playing baseball, that if they saw all that bad stuff that went on, that they would say, hey, this is too much. We don't want all the stuff, the negative stuff that goes with it. So we're not going to let her play college baseball. We're not going to let her play professional baseball. So the idea of projecting that everything was perfect when it wasn't, and having to keep all that down and in, was extremely difficult and hard. And now, being older, I want to expose that and tell people, just so, you know, another girl or even another guy going through a tough time in the minor leagues, you know, can see that, you know, they're not the only person going through that, and it's okay to get through that and, you know, get through it in a stronger way.
I think that so much of your writing is about that journey to opening up a little bit more, and that's something we talk about a lot today in baseball, is how much emotion do players have the right to show? Obviously, it's different for you because society tells women we have to behave a certain way and show certain mm-hmm. emotions in certain times, but how much do you feel like came from the game of baseball that was dictating you, your emotions, versus the wider world or the way you were brought up?
I still struggle with that even when I watch baseball. You know, I was brought up to play the game hard, never show any emotion. You know, one of the things my dad taught me when I was on the mound was always to control your emotions. If somebody hits a home run off of you, you know, it looks the same way as when you strike somebody out. Mm. And, you know, I watch baseball now and it's very different. And so I even struggle with that. But I like the idea, you know, there's a lot of emotion that goes into it. There's a lot of hard work that goes into it. You know, you see the guys win the championship and, you know, you have people crying and excited because there's so much time and so much energy that has gone into it. And I think it's okay to express that emotion and be happy. I think it's just, you know, any time that you're degrading or showing somebody else up, then I think that crosses the line. But I think you could show emotion and be excited and do that. And you're starting to see baseball open up to a lot of different things and trying to be progressive. And I applaud them for that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly opening up a little bit. So speaking of showing excitement and positive emotions, what was your favorite moment on the field during your baseball career? What excited you the most?
I would say the game that I talked about in the book, it was against Fargo-Moorhead. They were the number one team. They led in every category. 60 Minutes was there, and they were filming me on that game. And I went six innings, gave up no runs, went against their best pitcher. The hitting over there was phenomenal. And I gained the respect of the manager that was giving me a really tough time. And to be able to pitch and come out of that and pitching on the road, that was a highlight. Now, we ended up winning the Northern League Championship, which was amazing. But as far as an individual feat, that was a highlight for me, and then being a part of the team, the Northern League Championship that year.
That is just one of my favorite parts of the book, because I feel like it's rare to get to see what a pitcher is thinking in each at-bat, and the way that you talk about it is really technical and exciting. I feel like I'm actually there watching the game.
Great. Yeah, it's trying to, trying to give people a little bit of what's going on in my mind. You know, when you're out there, it is really is a chess game, and you know, people just think it's throwing the ball past the person or, you know, putting it on the outside. There's just so much that goes into baseball, and that's why I love it so much.
Yeah, I think that you are the definition of a crafty left-hander, and I loved seeing the way you thought about those individual moments. Like, what can I do? There's this great moment when you think, I want to get this guy to foul one off. Can I do that? And seeing that amount of control, seeing the way that you think about it, is something that I think is very unique, and that we all wonder about pitchers and never really get to experience ourselves if, you know, we don't think like that. Can you think?
Right. Okay.
It's really good.
It's just funny because I go see a baseball game, you know, and this guy just rips it down the third baseline, and I hear my friends, oh, my gosh, if they throw another one like that, oh, my gosh, it's going to be out of the ballpark. And I'm like, well, maybe that guy did that on purpose,
Yeah, it's just the kind of thing, like the kind of seven steps ahead thinking that I don't think that the rest of us are aware of. So what was the hard, I don't know if you remember, but what was the most difficult at bat that you can remember? Who is the toughest batter to face?
Ooh, gosh. I'd say J.D. Drew. Mm. He was on my team for a little bit, the Saints, and then I faced him. And the toughest hitter to me, I think if you ask any pitcher, is getting that third strike. I mean, you could get two strikes, but you're throwing everything at them, and they're fouling it off. And you're like, oh, my gosh. You know, whatever I give them, they're just fouling it off. And finally, not that you have to give in, but they're just waiting for a mistake, and your good pitches, they foul off. And he was very difficult to pitch to. And I found him to be the toughest person that I faced.
He definitely, I could see how that would be very difficult. What's it like when you're trying to work a new pitch into your arsenal? Because you write about that too, to some degree, which is something I'm just fascinated with.
I wish I could learn something fast. What I've learned is it takes a long time. You know, talking to my baseball friends, they're like, why does it take? You know, this guy said that he's just starting a split finger, and he's been working on it for a year and a half, you know? And I'm like, yeah, it took me, a long time to develop my straight change that kind of worked as a screwball. And, you work on different speeds. You work on different spins. Then you have to control it and place it, and it just takes a really long time. If I didn't have that screwball that was a straight change, I would not have made it in professional baseball. And so it took me some time in college to perfect that.
What you also write about how someone said, like, oh, learn the knuckleball, try to learn the knuckleball, and that it's just, what is it that makes a pitch easy to learn or hard to learn? Is there a distinction there?
I would say for me at that time, it was time. Maybe if I worked with the knuckleball a little bit more, maybe if I worked with some people with that, I didn't really give it that much time. I tried it, but not the time that I put into the screwball, because I needed something running away from a right-hander that looked like a fastball. Mm-hmm. And that's what was going to make me successful, so I worked on that. As far as a knuckleball, yeah, if I could have worked with somebody maybe in the off season, maybe that would have helped me get even further down the road. But I've been very lucky. You know, usually girls have tiny hands, mm-hmm. and my hands are bigger than my dad. So I've been very lucky to be able to throw a split finger or to possibly throw a knuckleball. I didn't work on it as much as I possibly should have.
Yeah, I still think that it's just so wonderful to read about these inner processes that I constantly wonder about in baseball players' lives. Like, you talk about taking these buses, the bubble bus with one team, and like spending time in the locker room sometimes with guys and pranks that would go on. What's the mm-hmm. weirdest thing that you ever witnessed your teammates do that is, you know, family friendly? Because there's some things in the book
family
that are
friendly.
Not super family friendly.
That takes out 90% of us, and now we're going to think of the 10. I would say, gosh, I have to think for a second on what I can say as far as the locker room.
Well, I think your book just gives this great behind-the-scenes look at indie ball. That we don't, it just works as that, too, in addition to being this story of being a female pitcher. It's
yeah,
really
there's
fun.
So many things. I guess one would be, you know, my center fielder, he was a character, and he would go to different ball fields and meet different people there, and he would always say that it was his birthday to these girls, and then so every time we would get into the clubhouse, we would have a cake, and it just got to the point where we were just laughing because we would always get cake everywhere. Every time we would go on the road, we'd get cake because he would say it was his birthday to certain people, and we always had a good time with that. It was pretty funny.
That is a pretty good shtick.
Yeah, that's just one. He would get jewelry. It was amazing. Like I said, the first year is kind of tough proving yourself. But after that, the guys were very supportive, and we had a good time.
You write about one of your teammates that really supported you when you were first coming up, Dave Glick.
Yes, David Glick.
And you became great friends. Mm-hmm. How did that friendship help your career?
Oh, he was my support system, and I was his support system. I didn't really have any secrets from him, and he looked out for me. He looked out for my arm. You know, mm-hmm. we would play catch. Nobody wanted to play catch every day, but we did. Mm-hmm. So we'd play catch with each other every day. We both liked to have fun. We were out there, and we just wanted to have fun. So we would play fungo with mm-hmm. each other. We would play games with each other. He didn't go to college. He went straight into the minor leagues. So I learned a lot from him. And then he knew a lot of the stuff that was going on, so he just protected me. He listened to me. He was just, it's like your best buddy you could tell anything with that looked out for you. And baseball in the minor leagues, I hate to use this term, but it's so cutthroat mm-hmm. at that time that I just felt like he was always giving me advice and looking out for me.
What more could you ask for, really? In a teammate.
Yeah, and I tried to do the same thing for him. And he was kind of a little bit on the edge, too. You know, when I was playing, nobody had tattoos. Mm. And, you know, he was a complete sleeve of tattoos, and he was always hiding them because he was told they wouldn't sign him because he had tattoos. So it was kind of like he was a rebel, too, and an outcast.
Wow, yeah, so many guys have tattoos now, and that's really... you know, I wouldn't think twice about it, but definitely boundary pushing at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I was looking at, what was it, Molina, and he had the tattoo on his neck was yeah. Dave, you know, he had some on his arms and he was constantly hiding them.
Huh. So you also read in your book about how you got a lot of media attention mm-hmm. as your career started to pick up. And I know this is media right now. We're doing an interview, but, How were some ways that you dealt with all the media attention? Did it affect your game at all?
Yes and no. I would say it affected my game in the long run because I was hiding who I was. And when you do that, you feel horrible about yourself, and you're so afraid you're going to be exposed that you're not really, I was friendly with the media, but not really open. I was constantly hiding. And that's not a great way to establish relationships, you know, and to be accommodating. But it was my own stuff that I was going through. But as far as the media working for me, too, you know, I got good press. The people, I think, when I was playing pro ball and when I was in college were very pro Isla. And I think they wanted the media for me to succeed. And I just was very young, and I didn't have a lot of security and maybe some advice on how to handle things, being the first woman playing in minor leagues. And I was just doing the best that I possibly could with being a nice person, but I just didn't have a lot of direction.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that a lot of young players struggle with. But of course, we had a guest earlier in the year, and her name is Debbie Shattuck, and she wrote a book called Bloomer Girls, which is about women's baseball in the 19th and early 20th century. And something she said to me that really struck me was that every time a woman starts to play baseball in the 20th century, everyone acts like it's the first time.
Right.
And that's something that I noticed from the way that you interacted with the media is they all put all this weight on you. Like, you are the person who has to carry this banner. It's only you, you and you alone. And you yourself note that you were not the first woman to play men's professional baseball, and there are other women before you, but nevertheless, you were kind of given this burden. What was it a burden to you at all? How did you feel about that?
Yeah, it was never about being the first. In my mind, you can go be the first. I want to be the best of the best. I want to be the best ever. Mm-hmm. That was my goal. I wanted to play professional baseball. I wanted to show that I was legit. I didn't play just 2 weeks. You know, I played 4 years. And I got a win. I got a scholarship to play baseball in college, and it paid for my education. I wanted to show that, you know, I love the game, and I have an opportunity to possibly make it to the major leagues, and I wanted to be the absolute best. And it wasn't about being the first, even though they would put that. And, you know, now, you know, there are 3 women in the Negro Leagues that played professional baseball before I did. And then Julie Croteau, she was the first woman to play college baseball, but I was the first one to pitch and win in college and get a scholarship. So you have all these different things, but my main thing out there was I wanted to be the best of the best.
Mm-hmm. What advice do you have now for young women who are also stepping into men's professional baseball? There are 3 women who played the Sonoma Stompers last season. There is all of the media attention for Monet Davis a couple of years ago. And I do feel that the media did sort of give this attention, which is like, oh, this is astonishing and new, and it's never happened, when in fact, you didn't retire that long ago. So I wonder if there's anything you'd like to impart.
Monet Davis, which I think she brought tons of great exposure to women playing baseball. And the more that can happen like that, that is fantastic. But yeah, I was watching that and I was like, oh my God, when I was playing Little League, there was a girl that played first base and they were in the World Series. You know? And I was like, this is such a big deal. But I remember her being the first girl to play in the World Series. And then the Stompers, I actually talked to one of them. Same thing. Awesome. I'm so excited for them to get opportunities and do that. But yeah, you know, there's 3 men that played in the Negro Leagues. I played 4 years, and then they were saying this is the first again. And it's like, no, you know, this is available. This has happened before. I think what needs to change, though, is people, and this is going to take time, is as soon as girls get to 12 or 13, they go into softball. Now, if they want to go into softball, then that's fantastic. There's a lot of great softball players, and it's a great sport. But I don't like that they're being pushed into softball because there's no baseball outlet for them. And I'm trying to get my book out there to girls to say, hey, wait a second. You don't need to be pushed into baseball. You know, I played high school baseball with the guys, 4 years, varsity. I got my college education played for with baseball, and then I played pro ball. And I don't think a lot of people know that there are opportunities out there. It will be an extremely tough road, but it's available. And if we can kind of give more outlets to women to keep on developing their baseball skills. I mean, you can't go into softball at 13 and then turn 20, mm-hmm. or you're out of college and then you try to go play pro baseball. They're two completely different sports, even though they have a lot of similarities. And that's why I'm really excited. Major League Baseball and USA Baseball is putting together Trailblazer Series this April in Compton, California, for 16 and under and 12 and under girls to develop their baseball skills. And I am so excited to be a part of that.
Will you be coaching pitching?
Yes. Yes, I will. And that's what needs to happen. I mean, if you look at Japan, you look at Canada, you look at Australia, their women's baseball program is huge. They have an opportunity to go to softball, which is fine, but they also have a baseball program. And that's what I would love to see as far as the future of women in baseball is giving them, you know, an outlet to keep on playing and developing their skills.
That's so important. That's definitely very important. I wonder if you have any advice for anyone who might be listening about what it's like to fight the fight to be a woman in baseball. Some things in your book are very harrowing, and I wonder if you think any of those things have changed.
I definitely think so. A lot of those have changed. The mental and emotional aspect, that's definitely going to be a huge part of it, and the pressure that's going to be put on somebody. You've got to love the game if you're going to subject yourself to all of that. Now, do I think women will go through that as much? I hope not. I think we're, as a society, progressing forward. But I still think there are going to be some obstacles there. And I would say, just when you're working on your physical game and keeping up on your skills, I would work on the mental and the emotional aspect of the game too, because it's just not going out there and playing baseball. There's so much other things that are going to go into it if a girl is going to make it to the major leagues and to stay with it. I wish I could talk to everybody as far as a female that's playing professional baseball or wants to do it, and she has any struggles, any concerns, whatever. I try to answer emails and just say, stick with it.
I think a lot of people need to hear that. You write about receiving angry letters and threats and people calling you really vulgar names. And mm-hmm. a lot of that, to me, didn't seem so different from what a lot of women in sports get on Twitter today and the kind of vitriol directed at them. You talk about like carrying these letters around just in case someone acted on the threats so that they would know who to look for. Is there a way to mentally prepare for that?
You know, what helped me, though, was playing from when I was 10, 11, and 12. When I was 12 years old, a huge sportscaster named Rick Lozano, he was like the big sportscaster in L.A., covered me with the media. And because I had to go through that at such a young age with being scrutinized in the paper and on TV, and I won some games, but I also lost some heartbreaking games. And that's what prepared me to help me in pro ball and to college is, you know, all those little things add up and you just get thicker skin and you're able to deal with it a little bit more. And that's why I think it's really important as far as keeping the progression of giving women a chance to keep on playing baseball. You've got to hone in on those, not just those physical skills, but the emotional and mental aspect of it.
Yeah, it's really good advice. All right, we're going to go to a couple questions from Twitter, just mostly about you and your life and your baseball career. The first question is, who, in your opinion, is the greatest baseball player ever?
Oh, gosh. I obviously, I'd say Jackie Robinson, because not only did he have to have the talent, the emotional and the mental strength of that man and everything that he went through and how he handled himself was just amazing. I would read every book that I possibly could when I was playing professional baseball on him, because I just wanted to do the best that I could to emulate his character. So I have a picture of him in my house, and he's very much inspired me.
Our next question is, so someone read your book and wants to know, you say in the book that many major leaguers at the time reached out to encourage you. One of them was Barry Bonds, who gave you his home phone number. And someone wants to know if you ever called him.
You know what? I did not. It's kind of like if you see a celebrity, you don't want to bother them, you know? I don't want to go up to him. But it just had a big impact on me and really taught me a big lesson that, you know, somebody can, the media or whoever it is, a person, could say a lot of bad things about somebody, and then you come up with your own conclusions before you even meet them. And then I met Barry Bonds, and he was the nicest guy on the face of the earth to me. And from that point on, I was like, at a very young age, I learned, hey, don't have misconceptions about people. Make up your own mind after you meet them. And here's this amazing guy in my mind that was very helpful and created a positive impact in my life.
That's so good to hear. And our final question from Twitter is, in your career, which of your mentors or coaches had the most influence on you?
Ooh. Gosh, I have three, and I don't know. They all had a certain timing of it, too. It's kind of like if one didn't do one, then the other two or the other people wouldn't have had the opportunity. So obviously would be Mike Vec. He gave me an opportunity to play pro ball. And then Charlie Phillips, he was the first man to give me a woman a baseball scholarship to play collegiate baseball, and he had to endure a lot from the other college baseball coaches and teams. And then Raul Esslinger, he went to bat for me in junior high so that I can play baseball at junior high and high school. So those three men, I can't really say one over the other because they've all had huge impacts on my life.
I think it's amazing that this was possible, that you were able to make these steps in your life. But I think, you know, you and your determination got you very far, and it's really inspiring to read about. I encourage all of our listeners to check out Making My Pitch. It's a great book. You can get it where books are sold, or Amazon, wherever you like to buy books. Isla, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
This was great. I hope we'll talk to you again if you ever feel like, you know, maybe talking about Trailblazers later. Let us know. We like you a lot. I personally really look up to you. So thank you so much for just, you know, working so hard and pursuing your dream so hard and being an inspiration to the rest of us.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. And yeah, hopefully we can chit chat again with the Trailblazers series going on mid-April. That'd be fun.
That'd be great. Thanks so much.
What a lovely interview.
Well, thanks. It was really great. It was really great to talk to you. I mean, as you can obviously see, I got a little bit gushy and emotional at the end.
I know. I don't mean to sound glib because I think it's extremely cool. And I am just, I'm glad that she came on the Cut Forecast to talk to us.
Yeah, and hopefully she'll be able to come back and talk to us about Trailblazers later this year.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. Guys, it's time for the moment that you have been waiting for. We must summarize the podcast into one tweet. 140 characters to accurately and adequately summarize our podcast into one chunk. Ian, because you were in a bad mood earlier, I'm going to make you go first. Ian, give us a tweet.
Okay, here we go. Last time I think I failed to complete a full tweet, so hopefully I'm going to get a full sentence out here, but I don't really know where it's going. The best thing about the Buster Posey Hugs blanket is that it can also protect your ears from audio lunch meat.
That is so bad.
No, it's great because I would be like, what is this? And if there was a link, I would click it because I would need to know what audio lunch meat was.
If you think about it, it works.
It's terrible. Gemma, what do you got? Give us your tweet.
Mine is going to be Cut 4 should make promotional items, starting with a singing bobblehead of Supreme Leader Ian Kay.
Stop.
That is true.
It would be at a karaoke bar.
I agree with that.
A karaoke bar.
That is a retweeted tweet.
Everyone knows the first Cut 4 promotional item is going to be a tank top.
I need it.
Coming soon.
Tank top.
Okay, my tweet. Most watchable player, ? Who cares? Best bobblehead, ? Who cares? The only news of the week that matters, : Theo Epstein is the world's greatest leader, ?
You can't just actually summarize the podcast in the tweet.
Do you think he's going to, like, give you a job now?
I don't think you guys understand how happy it makes me that Theo Epstein is the world's greatest leader, and I need to share that information with as many people as many times as possible. If you have a tweet that better summarizes our podcast into 140 characters, please tweet it at us, at Cut4, with the hashtag Cut4Cast. You can go to MLB.com/Cut4 to read all of those articles we were talking about earlier, as well as many, many more, both this week and all throughout the season. We'll keep you abreast of everything that is cool that is happening in MLB. You can follow us on Twitter at Cut4. You can like us on Facebook, Facebook.com/Cut4. We also have Twitter accounts. I don't know if you care. Ian, what's your Twitter account?
At ENK. Underscore?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut off your underscore. Very important.
It's pretty important. Gemma. You want to reach me.
I don't want to hurt your hashtag brand. Gemma, what is your Twitter account?
I'm at Gemma Kaneko.
I'm at Dakota Gardner. We're both professional, unlike the fearless leader.
I did tweet this week. I tweeted at Dakota. I hadn't tweeted in a long time.
Good job.
I'm back.
Welcome.
That's impressive. If you have questions that you would like us to answer on the Cut Forecast, or just, you know, in life, you can email us cut4cast@mlb.com. That's any questions, comments, concerns, life advice, ethical quandaries, whatever you want, email us cut4cast@mlb.com. And this is a podcast that you have been listening to. You can leave a rating or a review on iTunes, and while you're there, you can subscribe, and then we will automatically download into your listening device, which is really cool. That's 2017 for you. Ian, thank you for being here this week.
So good. I'll be back soon.
We'll see about that. Gemma, thank you as always for joining me.
Of course.
But mostly thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.